Hello, welcome to Life Matters. Yes, Natasha Mitchell with you for the next hour of your morning. Great to have you with us. From ghosts and goblins, atoms and x-rays, why have we always been intrigued by our imaginings about the things we cannot see, with stories of concealment and corruption, invisibility cloaks and spells to make you disappear?
There are some fantastic ones from around the Middle Ages. When everyone believed in magic, people believed that it would be possible to do this through magical means, and some of the spells are extraordinary. I mean, one of my favourites involves the head of a severed man, the severed head of a man, I should say, who commits suicide. So you have to find such a thing somehow, and then you have to bury it in the earth with seven beans and water those beans with good brandy for 7 days, after which time a spirit will appear and will look after the beans. And then you have to find a young girl to pick the beans when they start to sprout. And you take one of these, put it in your mouth, and you will be invisible.
And you will be invisible. Wonderful science writer Philip Ball has written an absolutely intriguing history, a cultural history, a scientific history. It's called Invisible, The Dangerous Allure of the Unseen. He's coming up today on the program. Hope you can stay with us. First up, when parents become activists, and did your child complete their NAPLAN, the National Literacy and Numeracy Tests, last week? Of course, they're held in years 3, 5, 7 and 9. NAPLAN was introduced back in 2008, and it's generated heated debate ever since. It's been the subject of 2 Senate inquiries, the most recent reporting last year. And while most students sit the tests, some parents have got activist on this issue and have become conscientious objectors for various reasons, refusing to allow their children to participate in NAPLAN. Here's a comment from our Facebook page last week. Kay writes, "My daughter is in year 9 and finds school stressful and hard work. Why would I put more pressure on her for a test that doesn't matter? I have withdrawn her this year and in year 7. She did it in year 5 and it was a soul-destroying experience. When the results came in, the mail, she angrily tore them up and threw them away. I was not going to let my child have that unnecessary trauma again." And we're asking this morning, does conscientious objection by parents and pulling their children out of NAPLAN, well, is that a useful response? Is it akin to taking your children out of religious education classes, for example, taking some sort of control over your child's education? Here's another perspective on our Facebook page. Fiona writes, "My little one did NAPLAN today and was filled with anxiety in the lead up, but came home from school strutting proudly and proclaimed he did awesome. A great learning experience for him. I don't care about the results, but I'm glad he's experienced a test and came out the other side feeling brilliant about it." So we'd like to take your calls on this morning. Could taking your child out of NAPLAN, because they're anxious about it, only perhaps serve to exacerbate your child's anxiety about tests? How do you and your children feel about taking the NAPLAN tests? Have you found the test scores useful, beneficial for you and your child? Has the school, if you did withdraw your child from the test, why did you do that? How'd your child respond? How'd the school or your teachers respond? 1300 22 55 76 or 1300 call RN. We'd love to hear from you this morning. You can text us to 0418 226 576 or tweet us at RN Life Matters. And if you're in WA, Northern Territory, South Australia, head to our listener line, 0283 1430. We'd like to hear from you right across the nation because, of course, NAPLAN happens everywhere. Joining us this morning is Ronnie, a parent who has withdrawn her children from the NAPLAN tests. Here's the thing though, Ronnie is a teacher. She's a high school teacher, so she sees this issue from both sides. Good morning to you, Ronnie.
Good morning, Natasha.
You have 2 children at different stages in your school career, in their school career, I gather. Has either child ever sat a NAPLAN test?
No, neither of our children has sat a NAPLAN test. Our son is in year 7 this year. So he's been eligible for year 3, year 5, year 7. That would have been 3 NAPLANs. And our daughter is in year five, so this is her second time she's been withdrawn.
Why?
Oh, why?
Oh, where to start with this one?
Where do you start with it? Okay. I first sort of heard of NAPLAN as a teacher in a classroom long before my children were ready to be tested. And I looked at the test and thought, what is this all about? Why are we doing this to our children? What does it serve? What purpose does it serve? I'm not against tests as such, but it was NAPLAN in particular. What it was actually testing, what the figures would be used for, and what the ramifications would be in the long term, not just for my children, but for schools and communities around the country. And looking at that, I could not go on with it. I had my own children. It wasn't that they might be anxious about the test. Tests are part of life. As a teacher, you see that.
Well, that's the thing. Tests are part of life. So are you making more of a fuss than is necessary?
It wasn't about them and how anxious they might be in a test and, ooh, is it going to damage them? That isn't genuine concern for parents, and I sympathise with them. In our case, at the beginning, it was about, I need to actually let folk know, just in my simplest way with my own children, that NAPLAN is not. NAPLAN really isn't for us, and maybe it's not for you as well.
What is it particularly, though, about NAPLAN that really gets up your nose?
It gets up my nose. I think when we were looking at it at the beginning, it was what questions were being asked on this. It's not something to test content that's being taught in classes. It's something that tests how you can do a test. If you were a teacher, like if we were testing for content, you'd be testing the things that the kids are learning in class, and you'd be looking in real time some feedback about how well they're actually understanding that information. And as a teacher, you could then use that information to see if you get that message across to them. NAPLAN doesn't do that. That's not what NAPLAN's about. If it was about sort of giving feedback to parents about how well your children are doing against, you know, other people in that year, you'd be getting the results back in a timely sort of fashion, so you could do something with that.
Have you not observed the teachers, though, using the NAPLAN results to understand where there might be deficits in their kids' skills?
NAPLAN gets done in May, and the results don't come out until about October, September, October. At that stage, you've got a few more weeks of the teaching year left. There's not a whole lot you can do with that if you've got some information. And the information that comes back is not something that's diagnostic. It's not something you can go, okay, so my class are not understanding how to do fractions. It's not saying this child here has got a problem with their cognitive functions. It's not doing that. That's not what NAPLAN does.
Well, we'll come to whether or not there's a benefit, though, in collecting this data across the school system, because data does talk. Let's bring it back to your own children, though. How have they responded to not doing NAPLAN? Kids kind of like to do what their peers are doing, and they can feel pretty awkward about being the odd one out.
The concern? In the first instance, when my son came of age ready for NAPLAN in 2011, he was in a small school, and he wasn't alone. It actually turned out that about four other kids in his class didn't do NAPLAN. That was a fairly high proportion of students in his class not doing NAPLAN. So he didn't feel at all out of place. It didn't have any ramifications when he came back to school, because in that stage when he was withdrawn, it was unsure whether or not you could send them to school and just withdraw them from tests, or whether or not you had to keep them home. And in the first rotation of the NAPLAN, he was kept at home for the 3 days of testing. And I sent the note into the school saying our son was missing from school because NAPLAN testing was happening.
Okay, so just briefly, how did the school respond to that?
No, quite fine. I'd spoken to them ahead of time saying he will not be doing NAPLAN. I am withdrawing him. We had a dialogue about what would be the best way of doing that, and that's why he was actually kept at home. It made it easier for them to not have to worry about how they might respond at school.
Okay. Ronnie is with us this morning. She decided to take her two children out of the NAPLAN testing regime. And I wonder if you've done the same. Have you put in a protest vote against NAPLAN on the and taking your children out? 1300 22 55 76. Or do you think that NAPLAN has a place? Have you found it a useful tool for your children? In fact, what have your children thought about NAPLAN? Perhaps you could share their views with us. 1300 22 55 76 on the text message, which is 0418 226 576. A comment. Tests are a part of life. Learning to manage the anxiety around stressful life events is more important than protecting them. If you don't like it, tear up the results. But teaching a child to avoid things they don't want to face is counterproductive. Lucy in Melbourne, you're a 24-year-old law student. I think you might agree with that point.
Yeah, I do. Look, I was actually one of the first students, I guess, to sit the NAPLAN exams in 2008. And since then, I've gone on to do VCE and, you know, countless law exams. It's kind of just making me laugh, these parents.
Life is an exam.
It's an exam. And it's really, you need to learn how to manage the anxiety. The paper is scary. The pencils are scary. It's all really official. But unless you don't intend to, you know, put your children through school and do exams in year 12 and, you know, further through to university, you need to start doing it at a young age. It's just something that you have to get used to doing, I think. And I think also, you know, for me, it's sort of, you need to have your weaknesses identified. You will for the rest of your life. And that's the only way you can, you know, improve on things. I found I was quite bad at maths. I went into tutoring and, you know, that was something I'd sort of hidden from my parents.
Okay, thank you for the perspective. Good luck with those final exams in law.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Lucy in Melbourne. Emma in Brisbane, another point of view on NAPLAN.
Yeah, look, I understand what Lucy is saying, but for a child that's, you know, very young and young at mind and heart, the last thing you want to do is quash them and crush any confidence that they have. I have a child that just struggles with going into an exam situation, high anxiety. The last thing I'm going to do is actually subject him to something that is really superfluous.
But he will have to do other exams at some point.
Absolutely.
Could NAPLAN not be a pathway to developing resilience around testing?
I think in this case, it's a lot of talking through things. It's a lot of gearing him up, and the last thing I need to do is give him up for something that is complete waste of his time, and dare I say the school curriculum's time should be spent on actually teaching them something that they will use.
So you don't see to,
sorry, go on.
No, you don't see the test being used in a way that's of benefit for the school.
No, I think it's a system and we're all just ticking boxes.
Okay, Emma, thank you so much for the call.
Thanks, Natasha.
On the SMS, NAPLAN pressure began for my eldest in year two. She was so anxious that we kept her home for year three NAPLAN. This time, new principal, less pressure. She happily sat it and so did her younger sister. In the end, we leave the choice up to the children while still objecting to the use to which the data is put. We're talking NAPLAN this morning. And in particular, we were prompted to have this discussion because we were hearing about activist parents who were taking their children out of NAPLAN testing, which has been happening over the past week or so across Australia. I wonder if you've taken that approach. 1300 22 55 76. Or perhaps you're quite happy to have your children do NAPLAN. Perhaps you're a teacher who has found it useful to take those NAPLAN results and integrate them into how you respond to the needs of the children in the classroom. Give us a call, 1300 22 55 76. With us is Ronnie. She's a parent who has taken her children out of NAPLAN. She's also a high school teacher, so she sees it from both sides. And we're going to hear from another parent in just a moment. But joining us now is Bronwyn Hinds. She's been a guest on the program a number of times. She's an education commentator. She's a public policy researcher at the University of Melbourne. Well, welcome back to Life Matters, Bronwyn.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're listening along. Do you understand Ronnie and other parents' concerns about NAPLAN? They see it as a test that isn't useful and that generates too much anxiety for their children.
I hear absolutely everything they're saying, and I think a lot of this angst and a lot of these perverse effects come from a misunderstanding of what NAPLAN is and what NAPLAN isn't. NAPLAN is a useful but limited diagnostic tool. It's just a snapshot in time on how kids, classrooms, schools and states around the country are travelling on some of the essential foundations of literacy and numeracy. It's there to identify the strengths and weaknesses so that policymakers and principals can work out where to target resources to have the best impact on learning. It is not a comprehensive measure of the capabilities of students or the teachers. It is not a measure of their worth and talents. Just one piece of little data to add to all the other forms of data to help families, schools and policymakers make informed decisions. It does not replace or even really compare to the sophisticated and constant evaluation done by teachers that's quickly fed back to students and parents. It does not replace this highly valued and essential work by teachers. Unfortunately, NAPLAN is frequently misunderstood.
Is it misunderstood not just by parents but by teachers, schools, and perhaps even the system that implemented it?
I think so. Well, surveys of principals and school systems, government and non-government, that were in the most recent Senate inquiry report talked about how these principals and policymakers saw it as very useful in working out how to target resources. Might should have shown students were needed some additional work on phonetics or direct instruction, or needed to work more on this aspect, or let's put some good teachers, more experienced teachers in this area, or let's put extra resources in that area. Mm. What is worrying is when some principals and some parents and even some students think it is the definitive score of how good they are. And that's not what it is. It should not be taking time away from other essential subjects.
Does it do that?
There is mixed evidence on this. It seems that some schools are doing this, but it's not thought to be systematic in any way. The best way to prepare for NAPLAN, and I'd like to repeat this, the best way to prepare for NAPLAN is not to prepare for NAPLAN. We want to make sure focus stays not only on these foundations of literacy and numeracy, but on all the other skills, subjects and capabilities that are essential to a student thriving beyond school. So cognitive skills, but also non-cognitive, such as creativity, social skills and resilience.
Did we hear that, folks? Let's recite it as a nation. The best way to prepare for NAPLAN is not to prepare for NAPLAN. I found myself sitting down and doing the Year 9 NAPLAN numeracy test last night, and it was fascinating. I could actually do it. We're talking about NAPLAN this morning. Bronwyn Hinds is with us from the University of Melbourne, a public policy researcher there, focused on education. And Ronnie is with us too, reading out a few text messages. Isn't this NAPLAN discussion a perfect example of parents putting their own anxiety onto their children? A tweet from Stephen: gee, I'm glad my parents didn't pull me out of class every time it was challenging. Ronnie, I wonder how you respond to those concerns.
I'll repeat, it actually wasn't about worried that they were going to be anxious about tests. They're going to face lots of them in school, they do. And I've not pulled them from any other tests. It is what NAPLAN is and what it does that I am objecting to. And I've listened to Bronwyn, and I think what she's saying is very sensible, and I agree with everything that she's sort of saying there about what NAPLAN should be, what NAPLAN, you know, the best way to prepare for it is just not to prepare for it. I agree with all those things. And I think schools and teachers know those things and completely agree with it. The problem is, though, when you do have NAPLAN, that's not what happens. Schools do need to prepare their children for NAPLAN, just to get them familiar with the basic mechanics of how this test works. That time has to come from somewhere. And it does come out of other parts of the curriculum. It is just simply what does happen. When there's mixed evidence, you can see that there'll be extremes at one end where there's a lot of time sucked out of other aspects of the curriculum, and right down to the other end where schools don't worry too much and don't do anything.
Which Bronwyn Hinds is part of that concern that teachers are teaching to the test, so to speak.
There's no real way to teach to the test because the test is new each year. You can teach the idea of how the test works, the mechanics of the test. But it's not actually testing for whether the child is actually learning the content that's being taught in the classroom. It's a test. It's like a meta test. It's a test of tests.
Yes. Let me come to Bronwyn. What's the evidence, Bronwyn Hinds, that NAPLAN is in fact being used as an educational tool?
What I'm using as my evidence is surveys of principals across the country, but also feedback from school systems, so the various state and territory school systems, and also some of the non-government school systems who have said they thought it was a useful resource, a useful set of data to use alongside other sets of data and working out what areas need a boost of resources and what areas perhaps we can learn from and share successes from.
Okay, let's take some more calls. John in Newcastle, a comment about parents. Have we got you, John?
Yes, hello.
We have. You'd like to make a comment about parents taking children out of NAPLAN.
Yeah, just first of all, I think that teacher that you first spoke to, personally, I think I've got two children myself, and I think that's, you know, very ridiculous what she was saying. If you pulled your children out of something every time it got hard, what's that, first of all, what's that teaching your children for later in life? Because things they learn at a young age stick with them, and I mean that's just showing them that it's an easy way out. Well, when you have cross country, if you're a bit tired, you tell them just to sit down, or you know, I mean, it's, where does it finish? I think another thing as well, after hearing some of the teachers, I wonder if the teachers are such against NAPLAN because it might highlight their inadequacies as a teacher. I mean, you know, any data you can get, any information you can get is useful. She also brought up the point that the results don't come back till September. Now, do those children come back to school after term, after Christmas? I mean, what, that can't be passed on to the next teacher or...
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems a bit... It just seems like a poor cop-out to me. And just another comment as well. I'd like to see, and I'd almost bet my house on it, that 99% of the people, the parents that are pulling their children out are white Anglo-Saxon kids, which I am myself. I bet you wouldn't see a Chinese surname pulling their children out of an NAPLAN test. It's just, it's the Australian cop-out way. We're getting worse and worse. We're getting lazy. You imagine going overseas and telling people that we're complaining about doing a test at school. I mean, you try telling that to people that don't even have water. I mean, it's almost, it's embarrassing. We should be ashamed of ourselves for even having this conversation.
Okay, John, thank you very much for being part of the conversation, though.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you. Jane in Victoria, your concern is that NAPLAN isn't child-centred enough.
Yes, that's right. I mean, other areas of children's services, for instance, you know, they're bound by Children, Youth and Families Act in Victoria, and that requires, like, anything you do with the child has to be child-centred. So the best interests of the child are first and foremost. And NAPLAN's a situation where, not always, but in some cases, the interests of the child is sacrificed for the interests of collecting the data at a national level. And having national level data is no doubt very, very important for planning. But it's only in order, if you were going to do a PhD at a university and you had to submit an ethics application, you would have to be able to demonstrate that what you're doing is of such overwhelming benefit that it's worth putting the children through whatever the intervention is, in this case, a test. And the children who are doing worst in school, which will be the children with developmental disorders of language and learning or other challenges of trauma or so on and so forth, the children who are a long way behind are exactly those who are likely to be most poorly affected by the test. Now, you could argue that, oh, okay, we need to know that these children are not doing well so that we can plan and put resources in place. But issues of dyslexia and dyscalculia and all, you know, that whole set of issues has been known for a very, very long time, and there's good information on them from other sources of information in the scientific community. And yet there's never been adequate supports to them in school. So I think where you have a child that meets that criteria that is struggling in school, it's very hard to make the argument that contributing to the data set of NAPLAN is worth it, putting the child through another test. When these children are tested more often than other children, when you think about all the assessments and everything that these children go through, how do you make the argument it's in the best interest of these children to sit NAPLAN,
okay,
given the track record the Education Department has of doing not very much support for these children in the first place?
Jane, thank you very much for that perspective. It sounds like you've got a personal connection to it.
Yes, I do. And when I pulled my children out for philosophical reasons, I had to fill out a form, and the principal demanded to sign off that my philosophical objection was valid. And I wanted to know where her degree in philosophy was, that she was fit to say that my philosophical objection was a valid objection. And I wrote down that, you know, if you worked under Child Families Act, you would have to prove that this is child-centred, and the NAPLAN test is not child-centred. If you were worried about children, okay, you would collect a much smaller sample.
All right,
and
Jane.
Not submit so many children to it.
Okay, that's interesting. Thanks very much. John in Queensland, your grandson's dyslexia was identified through NAPLAN.
Yes, that's right. I suppose they knew he wasn't doing brilliantly at school, but it wasn't really until NAPLAN that they realised, his parents realised the seriousness of the problem and were able to do something about it. So because of that, now in high school, he's never going to be at the top of the class, I suppose, but he's doing quite well, mid-range student, and can enjoy his education.
Okay. I'm surprised that they didn't pick it up before NAPLAN.
Well, what would that have been? In year three?
Yeah.
As I say, it was clear that he had some difficulties, but it hadn't been picked up, and I'm sure there are other kids around in the same sort of situation.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
Very much. Dave from Kelso's texted, there is a lot of parental codswallop around NAPLAN. In the 1960s, Queensland exams were held at the end of each term and report cards issued. Good prep for a lifetime career with annual evaluations for career planning and further training, whinging parents, and impediment to their child's progress. That's Dave from Kelso. I'd like to bring into the conversation now Lou. Good morning to you, Lou.
Hi, Natasha. How are you going?
Very well. Thanks for waiting on the line. Your daughter in Year 9 has sat each NAPLAN test, but you're in fact having second thoughts about its value. On what basis?
I feel like it sort of slipped in past my my vigilance as a parent. and now I'm at the end. My children have all done all their NAPLANs and they're all finished. But I'm a bit disturbed by the misuse of the NAPLAN. I'm not against testing. I think testing is really important for students and teachers to see where they're at and to see where they need to pick up. But NAPLAN doesn't fill that niche. And my daughter's school is... When she came home a couple of weeks ago saying they had NAPLAN, she told me some things that disturbed me.
What disturbed you in particular? Your concern is that it's being used in an inappropriate way in relation to your daughter and outcomes, yeah, in terms of opportunities for her. Can you be specific for us?
So teachers were telling the Year 9 students at my daughter's school that this was very, very, very important and that it would determine things like whether or not they would get into uni. Now, we're talking to 13 and 14-year-old kids, and my daughter's actually only just sort of recently decided she'd like to go to uni, and she's being told that this set of tests will determine whether or not she will get into uni. And she actually is quite anxious about tests. And I'm telling her one thing and I'm saying, well, no, NAPLAN is used to gather a picture of what's happening with your school and across the country, and it's not a pass or fail test. And yet she's actually being told by teachers at her school that it is. If you fail NAPLAN, you will have to do... what's it called? It's another test they have to do. I've actually been on the West Australian Education Department website, and it clearly says to achieve a WACE, which is your West Australian Certificate of Education, from 2016, students will need to demonstrate a minimum standard of literacy and numeracy either through pre-qualifying by achieving Band 8 or higher in reading, writing and numeracy in the Year 9 NAPLAN, or through the online literacy and numeracy assessment.
So you also specifically, your daughter's an A-grade student in Year 8 and 9 English, but in fact you think that her NAPLAN results were used to hold her out of an English enrichment program?
They were, and I was
Do you know that for sure?
I do know that for sure. So in WA, our Year 7 students in WA only just started. This is the first year we've got all our public Year 7 students in high school. So my daughter in Year 7 was in primary school yet still. And so I didn't realise, but the school used their Year 7 NAP plan results combined with their Year 7 school report to determine whether they'd be offered a place in enrichment or not. So they were streamed before they even got to high school.
Okay, let me come to Bronwyn Hinds on that from the University of Melbourne. When you hear a story like that, Bronwyn, what comes to mind? NAPLAN is not meant to have detrimental outcomes for students, individual students. It is a data collection exercise across the nation.
Absolutely, and I'm very worried to hear about everything that Louise was telling us about how it's being used or misused, I believe, in WA. It is not a comprehensive measure of the capabilities of students, and it should not be used to determine whether they should go into one stream or another, and it certainly does not have bearing on to whether they should go to university or not. I will be following this up, actually, because I'm deeply worried about this, and I think it just exacerbates some of the misunderstandings that exist elsewhere around the country, where it's hugely and unhelpfully conflated, resulting in this anxiety and misuse of class time by a small number of teachers or schools around the country. We really need to put NAPLAN back in perspective. And there's one very simple and quick way that we can do this. It will take 5 minutes. Mm. We could put on the NAPLAN website, NAPLAN is blah, blah, blah. NAPLAN is not. It is not clearly communicated on the NAPLAN website. I've checked this many times. I was checking it last night, actually. And it does not reassure parents about how it is meant to be used. It does not reassure parents to help them reassure their own children. It does not reassure teachers. And I think if we take a few deep breaths, we provide this extra reassuring material out there, we can actually get back to, you know, focusing on the broader educational picture.
Let's take some more calls. It's a full board, and sorry, I might not get to you all. Rebecca in Wollongong, your little boy really enjoyed NAPLAN.
He did. He really likes the testing process. I think if I had an anxious child or a child that didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't encourage them to do it. But he does really enjoy it, so we embrace the whole process. We don't put very much focus on the results when they come back. But, yeah, he does enjoy it.
Mm. Excellent. Thank you, Rebecca.
I will just add, though, that the caller, Lou, my opinions about whether or not I would send my daughter have changed slightly since hearing that caller speak. I'm not sure whether I'd thought some of those issues through. But, yeah, for my son, I think it's been a positive experience.
Okay, thank you very much, Rebecca.
Okay, thank you.
Kimber in Melbourne, what would you like to add? That doesn't sit NAPLAN.
That's right. So, first of all, just a disclaimer, we have to offer NAPLAN every year. It's a legal requirement. But as a community, we're probably the only parent-run school in the country, I believe, and we're a cooperative school, which is consensus-based, so we all make decisions as a whole group. And the group has decided for many years that, you know, NAPLAN doesn't sit at all well with our philosophy of individual learning, and that learning is a journey, and that my learning has nothing to do with your learning.
But doesn't testing have a place?
Look, if a child wants, we sometimes do the practice test. The kid says, oh, what's that? I want to just see how I'm going in A, B, you know, maths, for example. Then sometimes those practice tests, you know, one kid might do them, and none of the kids in recent years have chosen to do them. But if they want to, that's totally fine. But we personally don't see that testing has a place other than individual chats with the teacher for each parent and their child and the child to work out what are my strengths, what are my weaknesses, and what are my goals. But my goal has nothing to do with your goal or another school's goal. That's how we feel. So we all choose not to sit the test.
Okay, thanks, Kimber, for the call.
Thank you.
And Stephen, finally to you. You're president of the New South Wales Parents Council.
Yeah, slightly different angle, Natasha. Mm. Just looking at the extensive research that the Whitlam Institute has done in conjunction with the University of Melbourne, they looked at 82 studies from all around the world done from 1991 to 2001, and where they identified a problem is when test results become the plaything of politicians, and with all due respect, Natasha, the media, because I think your program is excellent.
Let it rip.
But the truth is that if you look at, there was a study done by the Australian Council for Education Research in 2007, the year prior to NAPLAN's introduction. They looked at 10,000 students, and a staggering 40% of them were either depressed or had low social and emotional well-being. Now, we've got no objection whatsoever to external testing. We think it's terrific. But as soon as you allow politicians to play with it, and as soon as you push it into the media, imagine what you do to the stress levels of that 40% of kids. And I can only imagine that those stresses have been exacerbated. So external testing, fantastic. But the test results should be the exclusive province of schools, teachers and parents. They should not be the plaything of politicians. And this was a terrible example that was picked up from the United States. The United States is walking away from this sort of testing now because they've seen that as soon as you allow it to be high-stakes testing, which is to say testing allowed to move into the political arena and the media arena, then you get all sorts of horrendous health results for kids, and particularly the very kids that we should most be helping, who maybe don't get as much help from their parents at home, or maybe have got other difficulties, or maybe are just naturally anxious. Those are the kids we should be bending over backwards to help, and this NAPLAN thing is killing them. And the real problem, Natasha, is that it's the plaything of nine governments, state and federal, and These education ministers around Australia are on the tiger's back, and I don't think they know how to unwind this thing.
Stephen, thank you very much for calling in. President of the New South Wales Parents Council, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
And I'll just come finally to Bronwyn Hines at the University of Melbourne. Would this discussion be different? Do you think it's a political plaything, or is there a place? Would it be different if, for example, the results weren't made public and catalogued on the MySchool website?
Well, I think everything can be made political. You just have to listen to 5 minutes of question time. You can see absolutely everything is drawn into political argy-bargy if you listen long enough. I think it is. There are still misuses of NAPLAN, but I think the potential benefits outweigh the potential problems. And I think it's useful to share this information, especially with the policymakers, but also to help parents look at what value schools are adding to their child. And listening to Kimba, I was very excited learning about her community and consensus-run school centred on the child. I thought, what a wonderful model. You know, we have so much to learn from different models. And then I was very disappointed to learn that we can't compare how that school does on using the exact same test that other children done. It limits our learning from other models. And there's one thing she said about how my learning does not impact on your learning. And I would beg to differ. I think there's so much, you know, really, we can really enhance learning by sharing and learning together and collaborating with each other, learning from each other's educational journeys and sharing skills and resources and expertise.
Look, terrific discussion, and thank you for all your calls. Bronwyn Hines, thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Education commentator, public policy researcher at the University of Melbourne. Ronnie, thank you for kick-starting the conversation for us.
No problems. I was so pleased to hear one of the callers mention the Whitlam Institute report. I'd suggest that all parents read that.
Okay, we'll put a link to that on our Facebook page and our website as well, the Whitlam Institute report. I've seen mention of that around a lot as well. Thanks for joining us, Ronnie.
Thank you so much.
High school teacher and parent. And Lou, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is my favourite program.
Oh, we're delighted to have you with us. And we'll put Lou and Bronwyn in touch with each other as well. As Bronwyn suggested, she'd rather like to follow up on your situation. Well, thank you for the calls. Get to our listener line, 0283 1430, 0283 1430, if you'd like to be part of the conversation, or our website, or scroll down our Facebook page to see the post I've popped up. We'd love to see your comments there. You can comment all over the place or email us as well. Natasha Mitchell with you on Life Matters here on ABC RN. I'm cloaking myself in an invisibility cloak now, and I'm disappearing. You'll still be able to hear me. The history, the science, the culture of invisibility next. Do you remember that scene in the Wim Wenders film Wings of Desire, where angels, invisible to mortal souls, peer over the shoulders of people sitting in a library to catch a glimpse of the words being read by them? That scene will never leave me or my consciousness. What would you do if you could become invisible? Who would you spy on? What mischief might you get up to? Maybe you'd use it as an opportunity to deliver random acts of kindness all over the place. Others might abuse the privilege of invisibility. There's a moral question here too. Plato took that one on. Science is said to be on the threshold of achieving the ancient dream of making objects invisible. I'm not so sure about that. But most stories about the idea of invisibility throughout history are not about technical capability, but rather about power and sex and concealment and morality and corruption, all the things we love talking about here on Life Matters. And I'm pleased to say that Philip Ball joins us. He's a leading British science writer, former consultant editor of the science journal Nature. He's in Australia. He'll deliver a lecture tonight based on an absolutely intriguing new book called Invisible, The Dangerous Allure of the Unseen, and it discusses invisibility in all its incarnations throughout history. He joins us in our Melbourne studios. So I can't actually see him. Philip, are you there, really?
I'm here, Natasha. Yes, I'm assuming you are as well.
I think
not just
I am.
A disembodied voice. Yeah.
If you were invisible, what would you do?
Well, you know, I'm increasingly asked that these days, and I generally tend to say I would resist that temptation entirely, because if we look at the stories we've always told about invisibility, they never end well. It seems that those stories warn us that invisibility is a real moral challenge, that it's likely to be a corrupting influence. So resist.
This was Plato's anxiety about invisibility, wasn't it? This the moral weight that it would present us, the moral weight of the challenge that it would present us with.
Yeah, it's like so many things, it all starts with Plato. He told really the first story of a ring of invisibility, and it's found by a guy called Gyges, who's a shepherd, who finds the thing by chance in the bowels of the earth. Straight away, what he does with it is goes to the capital of the kingdom, seduces the queen, kills the king, and sets himself up as the ruler. And Plato's point was, he tells his story in his book, The Republic, and his point is about creating a just state. And he says, which of us, if we had the ability to evade responsibility for our actions, which of us would be able to resist doing things that we really shouldn't do?
And this is why you describe invisibility as a mighty power and a terrible curse. And we've had a turbulent relationship with it. Although throughout history, this is such a delicious book. It takes on so many domains of human endeavour. But there have been all sorts of intriguing recipes, almost spells for invisibility.
There are some fantastic ones from around the Middle Ages. When everyone believed in magic, people believed that it would be possible to do this through magical means. And some of the spells are extraordinary. I mean, one of my favourites involves the head of a severed man, the severed head of a man, I should say, who commits suicide. So you have to find such a thing somehow, and then you have to bury it in the earth with seven beans and water those beans with good brandy for 7 days, after which time a spirit will appear and will look after the beans. And then you have to find a young girl to pick the beans when they start to sprout. And you take one of these, put it in your mouth, and you will be invisible. Now, it's not clear. In the story that's told of this recipe, we're told that a couple of merchants in London tried this. They didn't get very far because a rooster came along and dug the beans up, so we never know whether it will really happen.
Damn those roosters!
Exactly, and the rooster apparently didn't disappear.
What was the unifying theme for you in this book as a science journalist?
Well, I think what I really wanted to get at, because as you say, Natasha, we're told we're on the threshold of science achieving invisibility in some sense. And so what I really wanted to do was to provide some context for that claim, to look at what invisibility has meant to us. And it seems to me that when scientists start invoking an essentially mythical or magical principle like this, mm-hmm. there's a lot of baggage that comes along with it. That, you know, when we've traditionally talked about invisibility, it hasn't been as a sort of technical challenge challenge of how we do this by doing things to the laws of optics. It's been as a moral challenge. And so there's this tension here between, you know, doing something in a technical way and looking at what that idea has meant to us socially.
And stories of invisibility have been wrapped up in people's beliefs about angels and deities and demons and the occult and ghosts and goblins and fairies and spirits and telekinesis and, you know, the stage play of magic shows. All these, though, have had a kind of incredible explanatory power, haven't they? And a social function, in a sense.
Well, I think that's why we have had stories we've had beliefs in ghosts, in invisible beings of some sort for so long, and we still have them. This is the interesting thing, that as technology advances, they don't go away. The internet is now full of ghosts because they have a social function. Ghosts do things. They, for one thing, make sure that we stick to the straight and narrow, because otherwise they're there to put us right. And, you know, that's something that is always going to be present, that's always going to be a necessity. So I think that's the important thing to bear in mind, that we have these beliefs not because we're just superstitious and easily, you know, led into false beliefs, but because there's a social function for them. And what I was interested in was exploring these ideas of not just invisible beings, but invisible realms of being. For a long time, people have believed in other worlds that are invisible. And we now have those scientifically. You know, we have stories of other universes, that including some that might be kind of superimposed on our own. I tend to think that these are just the modern manifestation of a very old idea.
Yes, and I did materials engineering, and so I've always been intrigued by the kind of the invisibility and indivisibility of the atomic world as well. And there have been many efforts over the years to render the invisible visible. All sorts of intriguing efforts that you document in this book: photography, X-rays, and much sort of kookier stuff besides.
Photography is really interesting because almost as soon as it was invented, it was discovered that it could show things that we couldn't normally see. In particular, it showed the presence of X-rays, and it showed radioactivity as well, could be registered on photographic emulsion. That was how it was discovered. And so these discoveries suggested to people that maybe photography can show us all kinds of things that we can't normally see. Maybe it can show us thoughts and dreams. And at the end of the 19th century, there were people who were claiming to have invented photographic techniques that could do this, that could record our thoughts, that could record our dreams in a way that could be interpreted, that could photograph ghosts and souls. You know, one of the first growth industries in photography was ghost photography. People were claiming, through what we now obviously see as double exposure, but at that time it seemed quite possible that photography could show us these beings that everyone believed were, you know, around us.
Yeah, it's absolutely delicious. Joining us on Life Matters this morning is Philip Ball. He is a British science writer, former consultant editor of the science journal Nature. He's the author of Invisible, The Dangerous Allure of the Unseen. If you're in Melbourne, you'll get to see him tonight at the University of Melbourne. I'll pop details at the end of this interview. But did the Enlightenment, did the industrial and scientific revolutions change our relationship with what we cannot see, Philip?
Well, it did change it, but not always in the ways that one might imagine. I was really struck by how in the 19th century in particular, from around the middle of the 19th century, physical science particularly became all about stuff you couldn't see. People started to really get to grips with what electricity was, what magnetism was, how that related to light. And so there was this idea that that the universe is pervaded by fields, by invisible fields. Gravity is another one. So more and more, physics became about the invisible. At the same time, we started to develop ways of detecting the presence of atoms, to show that atoms are real. And these, as you say, are invisible just because they're too small to see. So they've been assumed, but no one had been able to get hard evidence for them. So this all happened at the same time as socially people became interested in spiritualism. There were, you know, mediums were said to be communicating with the dead. And it happened at the same same time that things like the telegraph and radio were invented, allowing us to converse invisibly over long distances. And so people, pioneers of these technologies, started to believe that perhaps they were revealing a link that the mediums were exploring between the living world and the dead world. And you find people who were interested in radio and telegraphy trying to use these technologies to investigate spiritualism.
Oh, yes, that nexus between religion, science, art, culture has been with us for so long. Let's fast track now to the present. And, of course, there were some you document some fantastic stories of how military minds became obsessed with keeping, you know, themselves out of sight in battle. Great stories of how they used nature as a source of inspiration for camouflage in battle, of whole ships and submarines and the like. Are we any closer? And you talk about metamaterials. Are we any closer, though, to rendering what we can see in one moment invisible in another? I mean, where are we at?
Yeah. Well, as you say, you know, camouflage is a kind of invisibility. It doesn't have to be perfect invisibility. It just has to be good enough that you can't really tell what is being seen. So there's always been, certainly after since the First World War, there's been interest in from the military in making things unseen. I was very interested to discover that in the Second World War, when camouflage became a particularly big issue because of aerial reconnaissance, some of the people that were involved in developing camouflage were the most unexpected sort of people. The camouflage units included artists, modern artists, who were interested in cubism, in breaking down the contours of things and, you know, rendering them ambiguous, but also stage magicians. Magic was still a part of hiding things, even at that stage. So that's one route to go down, to have better camouflage, maybe camouflage that can adapt to its surroundings using kind of wearable TV screens, in essence. But these things that you mentioned, metamaterials, are doing a different way. They're trying to hide things by bending light in ways that previously had been impossible. In essence, by bending light rays around an object and then bringing them back together again on the far side, a bit like water in a stream or running around a boulder sticking out, so that at the far side, all you see is this parallel beam of light that had come from behind the object.
And so it's an illusion, nothing effectively. There.
It is a kind of illusion. In fact, it's literally that, because you can set up the same kind of illusion in a slightly cruder way using mirrors or using prisms. And people have done this. And it's not so different to what some Victorian stage magicians were doing to, you know, try to hide things, try to hide people's bodies on the stage. So, this is another direction that we're taking. And now we're able to build these so-called metamaterials that can do this to light. And they've already been used to hide things in at microwave wavelengths, which is the kind of radiation that is used for radar. So, you know, it's potentially possible to make things kind of invisible to radar. Whether we can do it for visible light or not is another matter, because it's just much harder to make the same materials. You have to make everything smaller because the wavelength of visible light is smaller, and that's still a challenge.
Oh, look, Philip Ball, I was like a pig in mud reading this book, I have to say. And it's delightful to have you in Australia. Thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters this morning. Good luck tonight.
Thank you, Natasha.
Philip Ball, his book Invisible, The Dangerous Allure of the Unseen, published by Bodley Head. If you're in Melbourne, he is speaking tonight at the Carlton Connect Initiative at the University of Melbourne, 6 p.m, Lab 14, that's 700 Swanston Street in Carlton. Wonderful Carlton. Look, next on the program, star of stage and screen, Colleen Hewitt.
You don't have a clue.
Yes, Colleen Hewitt will join us. Her most personal album of all, Hidden Histories, a real celebration of her resilience. Looking forward to that. Thanks so much for your company today. That's it from us. Coming up to the news now on RN.